Howdy, folks, and welcome back to another episode of Meta Ideological Politics. Today, we are here with Jason Snyder. Dr. Snyder has an educational background in applied economics and geography, and is currently teaching in the Department of Sustainable Development at Appalachian State University with a special interest in local food systems. He is also a beginning homesteader, in the Appalachian Hills, a meditation enthusiast, a podcaster from the Both and Doomer Optimist podcast, and a proponent of societal transition towards a more resilient and regenerative system and state. So, Jason, great to be with you, brother.
Great to be here. It's an honor. And I've heard some of your podcasts, and I really like what you guys are doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So tell us more about that. what do you make of what we're doing? What is your... your understanding, and how do you relate to this idea of meta-ideological politics or meta-ideological thinking in general?
Well, Jared and I were just talking earlier about how we think that you are probably the best mimetic mediator, kind of like the top of the, you know, cream of the crop. And together, both of you, I think, I remember I listened to your first episode, and it sounded great. It seemed to be you were talking about this idea of mimetic mediation and applying it to politics. So usually that term is kind of meant in the kind of the sense-making space, but you were saying, okay, but we need to get out, you know, get involved with local politics, understand where people are coming from. There seems to be kind of a practical, pragmatic bent. Both of you want to run for office someday. So that was interesting. And I think kind of refreshing. I think a lot of the sense-making liminal web type stuff is a little bit abstract, right? And a little bit cloistered and trying to like stay pure and away from politics. And so the fact that both of you are really wanting to wade in, you know, I think is really good. It's a little brave because I'm sure you can step on some landmines. And then you've had some good guests on. Layman Pascal is a wizard. Always like listening to him. And I think I listened to one with Jeremy Johnson and somebody else. And you were talking about who was talking about the Graeber book? Or is that a different, maybe I'm mixing up podcasts here. So I've just really enjoyed it. I haven't caught all of them. So I know you've done some on education and stuff. I'd like to catch up on some more. So, but I just like what you're doing. I think you're on the right track.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate hearing that. And in the spirit of this kind of refreshing, get out there, do something practical kind of thing, there was a tweet you had sent out, I think last year, that I really loved. And it was something, I think it was like something about the meaning crisis. And I think David Fuller was somehow implicated in that tweet. And you said something like, enough talk about the meaning crisis, motherfucker, go plant a garden. Do you remember that tweet?
It was something like that.
Something like that, right?
Yeah.
And I think the spirit of that, we're trying to promote on the show of like, my equivalent would be plant a garden. Yeah, absolutely great. Mm-hmm. I live on 5 acres, so hell yeah to that. Yeah. But also like go out and serve your local community in some way, right? Yeah. Get civically involved and don't just retreat into these online niche spaces, right? Go into the real world as much as is possible during a time like this and go and build some bridges and connections with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Yeah. That tweet, sometimes I like to shitpost. Sometimes I just like to be a little provocative and a little ironic or something. I think the end of that tweet was like, stop being a consumer of meaning. So kind of to make your own meaning. And I understand that sentiment, that sensibility is a little bit, it might be a little bit closed-minded or a little bit narrow or myopic in focus, but I think sometimes it's necessary to actually, Joe Norman emphasizes this a lot of like the sense-making part, we need to emphasize more the making part, making the sense, right? Like carving out a sphere where we're helping to order things and we're collaborating in a space where we can help make the sense, right? We're not just trying to understand what's happening and develop theories about it. We're actually, you know, helping to formulate, you know, a kind of microcosm of you know, that's made. And that can be starting with, you know, cleaning your room, that can be planting a garden and engaging with your local community, absolutely. You know, reaching out to neighbors that, you know, might just have no idea what you're talking about if you use any of the fancy, you know, sense-making lingo. But, you know, and there's also this interesting, I think, distinction that I've been thinking about a lot lately between physical localism and digital localism. And physical localism is like, you know, obvious. It's like your neighbors. And the advantage there is that it's situated. These are people that if there's some kind of disaster, kind of emergency, that if you develop good relationships with, you can rely on, you develop patterns of interdependence. But you might not always, especially this day and age, you might not really vibe with them intellectually or ideologically. And so it's kind of a, you know, a practice of, you know, understanding multiple viewpoints, you know, collaborating with people. Digital localism, on the other hand, is kind of like this clustering, you know, of people online based on common interests, right? And that's also nice as well. I'm really, you know, grateful for that affordance that we have to do that. And then I've been thinking about the relationship between these two kinds of localism, as I framed it, right? And they could, you know, they can kind of be parasitic on each other, or they can be synergistic on each other, right? Like they can be parasitic because if you're online too much, if you're worried about this larger sense-making conversation, you know, it can really just, you know, take you out of your life, you know, literally, also emotionally, mentally. And it can also, like, you know, you might get ideas online and then you might start seeing your neighbors a different way, and it might sow new divisions in your locality because all of a sudden, you know, you see certain people as the enemy where you didn't see them as the enemy before. And so it can, you know, can have a, you know, not great relationship. But on the other hand, you know, it can also infuse ideas into localities, right? And it can bring in fresh ideas. It can also help with like collaboration across localities to have, you know, kind of a cosmopolitan type of localism where you're situated, you're embodied in your community, but you're also part of the larger conversation of other situated communities. And I think, you know, that potential to me is probably the best chance we have to survive the future.
Let me say anecdotally, Jason, I saw that tweet last year and I directly afterwards went and I bought like a thing to plant and do a garden. And it was actually quite direct.
Yeah.
So I went out and did it. And then I dug this big trench in my mom's backyard because I'd just been evacuated from where I was. So I was with my mom suddenly because it was the height of COVID. And I was like, I'm going to plant you a garden, mom. And so I went outside, I planted this garden. I was out in the dirt. And it was also at the same time, it was when I was getting quite involved with the Stoa and with the whole liminal sphere and everything. So it was, in my case, quite mutualistic. And I do remember after I would come in and from gardening and setting this whole thing up, I felt empowered. It's that kind of making spirit.
Yeah.
So anecdotally, nice. Let me thank you, Jason, for that.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful to hear. I mean, that's, you know, that helps me get up in the morning of, you know, why am I spending all this time online? Well,
why are you shit posting so that people
What did you grow? What did you grow in those beds?
We did basil. Nice. We did oregano. We tried tomatoes. They didn't quite work. Something with the soil.
Yeah, tomatoes can be tricky. Nice. Yeah, basil and oregano are not too difficult to grow. They're pretty kind of sure things, and they're abundant, which is great. I mean, you basically have more than you could ever want on a tiny little space. That's awesome.
Good deal. I think we should be talking more about basil and oregano and things like that in this sphere. We really should, because it's the particularism of it, that it's a 3x3 foot plot, and from that it can expand the rest.
Right. So is it highly raised bed?
No, it's not raised. It's okay. Well, it was an uneven surface that I did it on.
Okay.
So like half of it is raised and half isn't. It's
okay.
Quite hilly. Interesting. I'm from Pennsylvania, so it's
interesting. Really, well, if we want to get into particulars, do you have a plan for maintaining soil fertility?
I don't. We sort of abandoned it because okay. I left. Now I'm in the city, you know.
Okay, so you left that place. Okay.
This escaped yeah. me, yeah.
Nice.
But we need to be in contact so that when I go back home, I can revitalize it.
Very cool. Very cool. And Ryan, you're the goat guy, right? You have goats?
I do have goats. I have 8 goats.
Yeah.
And I did have a big garden out here before my landlords converted the space into a vineyard. But actually, my background is in permaculture and agriculture, you know, living in Hawaii, and was really into gardening and you know, sustainable agriculture. And I worked as an AmeriCorps member, NATO too, actually, in Indonesia. I did Hawaii for a Waldorf school that grew organic vegetables for school lunches. So that's kind of my background. It all died once I moved to Portland into the city and didn't have an opportunity to do that. And I was, I don't know if there's a word for it. It's like green withdrawal or something. Like it was brutal, just a year and a half not being able to dig in the dirt and plant all of my favorite stuff. My favorite, I want to give a shout out to my favorite thing to plant grow ever is daikon radishes.
Yeah. Okay. I haven't done those. I've wanted to in order to help, you know, improve the soil.
Yes.
Get the deep tap roots going.
Exactly. Yeah. They're that bio drill, right? You just like get them in there, and then they're great. Yeah. You can pickle them. You know, you can like hit someone with them in the head. Like they're very multi-purpose.
Good
you know,
defense.
Even like fencing with them.
Guns,
right?
You need guns when you have daikon radishes.
Exactly. Right. My daikon radish rights. Nice.
I'm gonna have to hit you up. Because I'm thinking, you know, quasi seriously about getting sheep or goats, probably either this year or next year. And I have the space. It's just
fantastic.
The apprehension because I've never done it before. So I might be DMing you for some advice here.
Do it. Yeah, we could have an entire episode just on goats where I'll give you all the books. I'll tell you which goats to buy. Fun. I'll tell you everything. I'll bring some of the goats here onto camera and we'll do like a live like milking demonstration or something, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, for sure.
That sounds great.
He names his goats after his friends too. I think there was a goat named Nate.
There was a goat. Later. I sold Nate. Sorry, Nate.
Oh, you sold him? I sold him. Did he fetch a pretty penny or?
Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, I mean, seriously though, like, you know, goat manure, fantastic. Composting, gardening with, right? I don't think it's too high in nitrogen, so it doesn't burn like chicken manure.
Yeah.
A lot of things you can do with them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I just need something. I have a kind of a big pasture area that, you know, it just feels a shame not to be using. And, you know, goats, you know, people like rent goats out as like lawnmowers, right? So might as well have a lawnmower that also produces soil fertility and perhaps some other highly nutritious products as well.
So maybe we'll talk a little bit about your podcast and the word doomer optimism.
Yeah.
And I was listening to some of your talks with Eclectic Spacewalk, I think. And you're kind of explaining what the term doomer optimism means, because it sounds kind of like an oxymoron or paradoxical. So can you maybe just take a few minutes, explain like, why those combination of words?
Yeah. It just kind of arose. So Ashley Colby actually coined the term. But I think I had written a couple posts about relating to, you know, a number of, I guess, ominous signs about the future, you know, in terms of, especially on the climate ecological side, and, you know, thinking about fear, thinking about foreboding about the future and what's the best way to relate to that, right? And so trying to, have a very realist point of view of like, yeah, things could get pretty bad, you know, with society. But at the same time, not, you know, so becoming a doomer, in other words, but not, you know, you can't really, that doesn't really get you up in the morning. And it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy if everybody just kind of gives up on their lives and society because they think it's all, you know, all for naught anyway. And so, you know, I think I originally framed it as like a kind of a pragmatic optimism, where pragmatic in like, you know, I'm not wearing rose colored glasses. I see reality as it is, but I'm going to choose to move forward as if there's hope. And so that I think pragmatic optimism is how I was thinking about it. And then Ashley, you know, said something about, well, what about doomer optimism? And that was a great term. And I was like, wow, okay, that's interesting. And then, it just kind of arose from there. We had a session. I forget the platform that we did the initial session on. We eventually got to the Stoa, did a series on the Stoa, and we just kind of kept using that term, and people were resonating with it, and it just kind of became its own. The meme kind of took on a life of its own, I would say, and then we just kind of kept rolling with it, to be honest. And then we started the podcast. Ashley's doing a lot of different things with it. Like she had these series of mini manifestos where she's getting a bunch of different people to kind of write about their vision of Doomer Optimism, partly to demonstrate that it's kind of a whole spectrum of thinking. And a lot of people who resonate with this meme don't agree with each other, right? Or they disagree pretty sharply about certain specific things. We're trying to just kind of keep it loose and fun. More of like, for me, it's more of like a structure of feeling. It's not like a movement. I don't like to think of it like a movement. We started up this podcast really, dedicated to, by the way, I'm going to be a little distracted, so I might as well say why. This is Kaleo.
What's the name?
Kaleo. What's that? Coin. Yeah, well, when we find more, we come over in there, okay? Okay, I'm talking with my friends, okay? Yeah, so, I mean, what we're trying to do is really just talk with, I mean, we have, we're trying to talk with people in particular who we feel like are really trying to take action in the world, generally have a kind of a common view of there's some kind of doom out there, and some people relate to it more on a political level, like institutions, politics is messed up, and other people are more of the eco, from the eco doomer lens, but people who are trying to, I think what you guys were talking about as well, like trying to build community, right? Trying to create resilience, trying to create, regenerative lives. Oftentimes is connected, connected to the land, but we've started having conversations with, with people about technology. Maybe we should just pause for a second. I'm just too distracted. So after our sessions on the Stoa, actually another friend of ours, Tress Crow, he actually came up with the idea of, hey, this should be a podcast, right? And sounded like a good idea to us. I was kind of missing the podcast days, from the both and days. And we decided to, to start with kind of a preseason where we were just trying to figure out in real time what structure it was going to take, what it was going to look like. And we kind of came to that we wanted it to be a collective where, depending on the episode, there would be different hosts, so rotating hosts. I think in total we've had like 5 or 6 hosts at different points now. And oftentimes people we interview end up being a host for a later episode. Cool. And so I think part of the idea of the podcast is trying to translate this Twitter community that started, was kind of attracted to this meme. Oftentimes it was people also who are interested in themes of localism and sustainable agriculture, permaculture, things like that. We just decided, this could be part of the community, right? It could be kind of a collective that, allow kind of our own little sense-making collective, you could say, where we're trying to, we want to talk with interesting people and have interesting theoretical conversations, but also interesting, more applied conversations as well. Reach out to people who are doing good work in their communities, permaculture design experts, as well as bringing in more recently people who, are really interested in technology and how we can think about technology that serves our values, right? That serves kind of, this intention of living with a lower, lower ecological footprint, and even perhaps in a regenerative way. And so we've had people on talking about like kind of like coordination, internet coordination technologies. We've had people talking about kind of Cosmo Local production, or, you know, related to Cosmo Local type production. And so, yeah, that's kind of where it's at. You know, it's still evolving. We're kind of just ending our first season and getting into our, you know, or ending our preseason, so to speak. And we're kind of, you know, okay, now we kind of have a flow. We kind of know what we're doing. We have a community. And so probably the production value will start to go up a little bit. It was pretty DIY, and it still is, but starting to get a little more organized. So yeah, it's been really fun.
So I'm going to throw out my reflections on the term doomer optimism.
Yeah.
And get Nate's response. But first, we need a meme that says, okay, doomer. You know, like if someone's being too pessimistic, like, okay,
doomer. Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking about it because I was like, what is my, or like, you know, implicit orientation towards the future in terms of assessing human civilization's trajectory, and are we screwed or not, or can we avert ecological disaster and some kind of collective crisis at large, or are we, you know, doomed for some really terrible dystopian future? And I think what I've come down on myself is I don't really care what the trajectory is, or even how accurate I think different trajectories are. Because my job is almost a sense of like civic duty, right? Like I have a duty to try my best and to help my community and to do what's best for myself and my family and my community and my country and for the planet, kind of regardless of the trajectory, right? So even if it is a doom and gloom future, I still have a duty to just try my best and help make the system better in any way that I can. And I don't know how that attitude or that structure of feeling contrasts with what you said. Because I think one thing that I thought about was like, what happens if the future really is bad and we can't avert severe crisis at scale? You know, to me, it's like, okay, but I'm still going to go out, you know, go down fighting, so to speak, right? Yeah. So even if I am a doomer logically, a part of me like doesn't really care. Like it's not even optimism to me. It's just like duty.
Yeah.
It's not a motive for you. Right. I agree with you there, Ryan. What I've noticed is that people younger than me, I think I'm kind of like the cutoff. People younger than me, the Generation Z, they have this kind of emotive doomerism as a default, I've noticed. That any optimism has to start from that foundation. Whereas me, I'm the same as you, Ryan. It's my mentality is like, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Like I really don't let it sink very deep down in this, the meta crisis, you know. It's just, okay, well, here I am in the world and I ought to be doing something, so I might as well fight against this. But that's because I'm privileged, for one thing. Mm-hmm. I'm quite lucky to be rich in a developed nation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, even among, and maybe especially among rich and privileged people there who are younger than me, there is that kind of doomerism as a base. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's effective about the meme is it takes that for granted and then speaks on top of it.
Yeah, well, you guys sound like doomer optimists to me. I think what you articulated is, if it's not the same, it definitely rhymes with, you know,
rhymes.
You know, the sensibility, you know, that we discuss and that we feel as well. But I think what you said, Ryan, about, you know, you don't really see yourself as an optimist. It's just, you know, you have kind of a duty and obligation to do your best and go down fighting no matter what. And I think that's kind of what we mean by optimism. Like we're not, I think most of us aren't really optimistic for a utopian future. That's not the type of optimism that we're talking about. It's more of an optimism that, you know, even in dark times, you know, we can still do our best, and perhaps we can carve out, you know, islands, you know, islands of coherence, of order, of flourishing, and, you know, bring as many people, you know, on as possible, you know, create lifeboats, so to speak. I mean, you know, as many as possible, and you know, ideally so many that it, you know, it helps to catch everybody. That's, you know, that's obviously the best case scenario, I think. Now that sounds kind of grandiose, but you know, it's a worthwhile life project, right? What else are you gonna do? but try. And for us, you know, again, and, you know, there is such an emphasis on kind of localism of what you can do nearby you with your neighbors. And then there's the emphasis on kind of the networking across localities, which we're just implicitly doing if we're on social media or doing podcasts in general. It's implicitly kind of already a networked or a cosmopolitan localism. So trying to kind of, you know, create kind of, you know, I hate to say the word movement, but it, you know, kind of a broad scale movement of, you know, people feeling empowered and see, you know, figuring out where they can step in and make a real difference in their own, but also other people's lives as well. So I think, you know, I think we're all, you know, we're all kind of on the same page. You all are doomer optimists.
There we go. We all share in these labels, right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it resonated with me, but I didn't take it on board or anything, but it did resonate me, and it kickstarted certain activities. Mm-hmm. And I kind of forgot that they did, to be quite honest. I thought back and I remembered that tweet of yours.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether or not you're taking it on board as some kind of ideology, still, you know, that there is a network, mm-hmm. you know, itself can be propellant.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was also intrigued, Nate, when you were talking about how, you know, especially people younger than you, you know, that's kind of their default kind of setting is, you know, a little bit doom and gloom. And I can't help but relate this to, you know, this kind of, you know, epistemic, you know, developmental epistemic framework of like modernism, postmodernism, metamodernism, right? Where, you know, postmodernism, that seems to be the era we're heading into, or we're kind of in the thick of right now, you know, of deconstructing, you know, the dominant narratives that, you know, that we've been told. And I think this happened first on the left, and now it's certainly happening on the right, right? Right-wing postmodernism, I think, is really coming to the fore now. And, you know, one way to relate to this idea of metamodernism is, you know, once you've absorbed all of that and you no longer, you know, you've deconstructed the dominant narrative of, say, eternal progress, you know, of kind of, you know, techno-modernism, then you can, you know, start to do something constructive again, you know, holding these memes, you know, not taking yourself too seriously, being able to wield irony, but not be, you know, embedded in irony, things of that nature. And I personally, I see, you know, doomer optimism as kind of an applied metamodern project. I'm curious what you guys think about that.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I think because it's taken that emotive foundation as an object, mm-hmm. which you've written about in an article that you wrote for the Side View a couple of years ago. I forget what it was. I forget what the title was. But you wrote about how metamodernism consists a lot in taking what used to be subjective as an mm-hmm. object. So there are that whole emotive core of like, we're all screwed in many ways together.
Yeah.
And putting it out here mm-hmm. and still moving around with it here.
Yeah.
It's a feat. It's mm-hmm. to say it out loud. It's like, how could anyone do that? But I think a whole generation of kids now is trained to do that. And needs to be, because otherwise they're doomed. They're just doomed.
Right. Yeah. No, it's interesting. What initially got me interested in metamodernism was my meditation practice, and the, you know, part of, you know, what you do in kind of Vipassana mindfulness practice is you take your feelings and your thoughts and you turn them kind of into an object of observation, right? Instead of kind of buying into the story of your feelings, you relate to it as kind of a sensory field that's more kind of objective, right? And it allows you to kind of process it a little bit, I think. And, you know, it allows you to kind of not, you know, hopefully not become, you know, kind of disembodied, but it allows you to kind of relate to it in a little bit more flexible way, and to see it as an object. And then, yeah, I think what you're referring to there is kind of like, that's how Kagan or Keegan talks about, you know, talks about these stages of like, going to the next stage is taking what was previously you were kind of subjectively embedded in, and it becomes kind of an object of your awareness, and you become subjectively embedded into a new, you know, a new thing that is, you know, that you don't quite understand, but is, you know, kind of forms your subjective emotional state. Yeah, I think, you know, part of moving, you know, from this kind of doom and gloom, deconstructive cultural mode to, you know, to one where, again, we have very kind of a pragmatic, realist vision of the challenges, but we move forward anyway, right? You know, we decide that, hey, we're gonna try and, you know, we have to transition to something better, something more wholesome, something more fulfilling. What else are we gonna do? You know, doomerism again is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So don't do that.
Yeah. Well, my question is, under the umbrella of doomer optimism and projects that you would consider to fall under that umbrella, in terms of people who are interested in taking pragmatic, locally rooted action, what are some other examples of initiatives good things people are doing in the community, other than like agriculture and stuff, that you've had on your podcast or that you're interested in like promoting as exemplars of this kind of philosophy?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I think I mentioned before, we had some guys on, so Eli Whipple, he's really interested in kind of distributed technology, and creating, you know, eventually he wants to kind of form these eco-industrial villages, right? So basically kind of eco-villages, but with some kind of distributed technology machinery that, you know, can greatly kind of, you know, assist with the project, right? So what's the difference between, say, you know, the hippies going back to land in the 70s versus them trying to do that today? Well, perhaps, you know, technology can make the difference between where these communities failed before and where they won't fail now. And so I thought that was a fascinating conversation. So, I mean, that's still related to kind of agriculture. I think, you know, one way or the other, you know, especially Ashley and I, you know, that's kind of our primary focus. We're probably soon gonna have, we had some Twitter interactions with the people in the new urbanism movement. I don't know if you're familiar with that, like Strong Towns podcast. And basically, you know, the idea, you know, I don't know that much about it, but the idea, from my understanding, is to try and basically do what you guys talk about as well, of you know, reinvigorating cities again, and in particular, kind of neighborhoods within cities. You know, creating mixed-use neighborhoods where people can live and do their commerce kind of locally. Of course, like urban agriculture and food forests and things like that. You know, trying to recover a lot of the kind of traditional architecture that, you know, was more sustainable, you can argue, definitely lasts a lot longer, and arguably is just more beautiful, you know, Wrath of Non style, you know, kind of sensibility. It's an account on Twitter who talks
about that. Yeah, he's great. Culture.
Yeah,
he's
great. Yeah, okay, that's it. So we're just, I would say, to answer your question, Ryan, is we're just starting to try and branch out more, right? So our foundation is definitely kind of like agricultural, permacultural. But, you know, I'm, you know, personally, I'm interested in kind of two areas of tech in particular, the kind of the cosmolocal production, like distributed technology, small scale kind of technology, linked up to kind of a global commons design and sharing, as well as, you know, I understand very little of it, but I am very interested in Web3, kind of crypto and what, you know, what that can afford. We are also going to have an interview soon with Gregory Laundra, who is the co-founder of Regen Network and Regenerative Finance. And so thinking about, you know, how we can harness these new web tools to incentivize, you know, regenerative activity, right? Incentivize carbon sequestration and communities that, you know, are providing ecosystem benefits, you know, and actually, you know, helping with the financial aspect of that as well as just the desire to do that. So, you know, I would say it's all kind of rooted in kind of the ecological, agroecological, permacultural stuff, but I'm trying to kind of connect with various communities and individuals that I find are doing kind of complementary things, right? And creating kind of a larger, you know, a bigger tent kind of coalition. So I don't know if that answers your question, Ryan.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I'm curious for you personally, Jason, mm-hmm. what is your personal like dream or ideal vision of where this could go, both in terms of its systemic instantiations and also just in your own life? Like for example, like are you in favor of kind of like the eco-village model, like what future thinkers or whoever, whatever mm-hmm. they call are doing, or are you more interested in educating your local neighborhood to engage in these kind of self-sustaining regenerative practices and to teach gardening that way? Or like, what is your theory of change that you're kind of, you know, trying to think about?
I'm still working through what that is. I know, you know, that I want to continue to develop, you know, my own homestead, you know, our family's homestead. I'm teaching at the university and teaching about related topics. And so I definitely want to continue engaging in, you know, the local food system in my county, for example, right? Like connecting with various organizations that are doing good work, that are trying to, you know, make food, you know, healthy and sustainable food more affordable, you know, providing equitable access. I'm very interested in that. And I think, you know, a little bit longer term, I'm really interested in this notion of bioregional regeneration. So I'm interested in networking with people across Southern Appalachia, you can say, and just kind of creating these kind of solidarity networks or mutual aid networks of people who are helping each other out, but also starting to build up kind of a bioregional economy. Right, that's more self-sufficient as a bioregion, and more regenerative as a bioregion. So, you know, I'm friends, for example, with Vince Horn. He lives in Asheville, a couple hours away. Right, we visit each other, and he's also kind of developing his own place and planting a garden, growing trees and stuff. And you know, there's a couple others that I've come across. It's actually interesting. One guy found me through the podcast, and he lives an hour away. And we visited each other's places, and he's doing great stuff. Him and his wife, you know, have a bunch of animals and are developing a place. And so I think, you know, that's kind of ground zero for me is my local community. But, you know, I'm intellectually curious. I like connecting with people, you know, from different parts of the world. And so I want to continue to be, you know, part of this larger conversation and this larger network as well. And so for me, it's just really kind of like nested, you can say, like, you know, nested networks, and trying to find what's the right balance, you know, in terms of my energy and attention, right? Not getting sucked online so much that, you know, it actually, again, takes me out of my situated, you know, context, but, you know, keeping up enough that, you know, I'm able to share ideas, help other people out, you know, get ideas that, you know, so, you know, beneficial mutual exchange. And so I think that's really it. Just trying to work at these kind of multiple scales that I think are, you know, so like the homestead scale and homestead family scale, the village scale, the county, you can say maybe the watershed, bioregion, and then planetary. And trying to manage all these scales in the interest of, you know, societal transition towards, you know, to face what's coming.
I'm curious, what is the reason for Southern Appalachia as opposed to somewhere else?
Yeah, well, it was just kind of an accident. My wife got a job offer at the university in the same department, and I followed her. I hadn't even heard of, you know, so we're near Boone, North Carolina. I hadn't even heard of Boone. And when we got here and I started getting involved with the department and started teaching, you know, I found that it really aligned with my values. I started to just really quickly kind of fall in love with the place. It's just physically a very beautiful place, but also kind of, I started reading up on a lot of the history, getting really interested in kind of like folk traditions, started reading, for example, like the Foxfire series, which is all about kind of like, you know, wisdom from the old timers of, you know, how they survived before kind of modern conveniences in this area. And, you know, both kind of, you know, telling stories of the old times, but also being like really practical advice of like, you know, what are some like wild plants that are edible, or, you know, how do you butcher a pig, or, you know, all of these kind of practical things. So I also got very interested in kind of the mythology of the place. I think it's really interesting as well because it's, you know, because of the topography, you know, the topography kind of enforced a certain culture. It enforced a culture of kind of self-sufficiency and resilience historically. Large-scale agriculture, industrial agriculture couldn't really take root here just because of the topography. And so you had a lot of like kind of isolated villages and homesteads. You know, it's also incredibly agro-biodiverse. Like there's just, you know, a lot of genetic diversity in the local food supply here, which I think is really, you know, a really wonderful source of wealth that we should continue and continue to develop. Especially, you know, with climate, you know, climate disruptions and things, having this genetic diversity, you know, I think can be really helpful. And so I just kind of fell in love with the idea of it, as well as just, you know, being here. It now, you know, to be fair, it's been hard just because, you know, we got here right before the pandemic started, and so I haven't engaged with the community nearly as much as I would like, partially just because we've had to isolate ourselves so much, right? And we've had to, you know, either various community events have been canceled, or, you know, we just haven't gone, you know, due to safety concerns and things like that. And so I feel like, you know, we're definitely lagging behind in terms of like robust community engagement, but and so, you know, on the other hand, it's given us time to start developing the homestead and things like that. So it's not all bad, but that's definitely kind of, you know, the next 3 to 5 years, you know, something that, you know, that is really important to me to pursue.
I want to bring in the cultural piece here and talk mm-hmm. about political polarization and agriculture yeah. and local food as a potential tool to help bridge the political divide and also the urban-rural divide. Yeah. One of the problems I've noticed is that in Portland, there are tons of really cool organizations. There's a nonprofit called City Repair Project mm-hmm. that does all these really creative things with like community artists, like, you know, and permaculture projects, and like Cobb the building like on a street corner, and mm-hmm. Transforming like abandoned plots into these thriving kind of permaculture micro paradises and stuff.
Yeah.
And they do all these really cool things, but their cultural vibe is so like woke, far left, uh-huh. right? Like anyone with any kind of conservative sensibilities, including myself partly, honestly, is very much going to be allergic and turned off from their just aesthetic presentation, cultural atmosphere from just being so deeply engrossed in this very kind of, you know, urban woke culture. Yeah. And so I'm wondering to, like, how like in terms of the ethos or the aesthetic, right? Because there's that kind of, you know, we talked about before about Wendell Berry's kind of conservative localism.
Yeah.
And so that can have a deeply kind of traditionalist conservative ethos and vibe and flavor, which can be attractive to people of that kind of bent, right? There's that resilience, there's a kind of rugged individualist pioneering spirit. Mm. And there can be a very like, just very, you know, I don't know how to describe it. This is kind of like the left, like, you know, hippie-ish kind of thing where everything else, you know, every other thing, like city repairs, like they're really into like, you know, indigenous like land acknowledgements and trans issues. And like, that's great as a kind of social justice thing. But my fear is that when you push that kind of ideological stuff too hard, it kind of, you kind of miss the opportunity to have a more universal inclusiveness ideologically and politically with projects that really should, everyone should be caring about, like caring for the earth, right? So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that and how you kind of mimetically, we can kind of mimetically mediate that in the context of things like regenerative agriculture and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting where we are. So Southern Appalachia in general, you know, you could say is quite conservative. You know, Boone itself, because it's a university town, is quite progressive, right? But once you get out of the city limits, it gets real conservative real quickly. And so there's an interesting, you know, dynamic that arises there. And even my department, you know, I would say my department is definitely on the eco-left side. And I totally vibe with that. You know, that's actually kind of my background, right? Like my parents were kind of like back to landers for a while. And you know, so I was raised in that atmosphere and, you know, kind of with a left sensibility. But there, you'd think that there would be a lot of tension there, but, you know, I haven't really noticed very much. I mean, I think everybody, you know, kind of people, you know, one aspect of the culture here is people are just generally kind of respectful. And, you know, in my department is interesting as well, is that, you know, you know, most of the professors in the department are pretty left, but they're also kind of pragmatic as well. You know, they work with, you know, various farmers and extension agencies. And so I think, you know, most people that I work with are able to do this kind of code switching a little bit, you know, within reason, right? Like people won't tolerate like racist diatribes or things like that. But, I definitely agree that, you know, one thing that can connect these two cultures, you know, the university kind of eco-left, you know, milieu that I'm in, you know, as well as kind of the more conservative localist sensibility is food and agriculture, right? Like local food is kind of definitely a unitive factor, right? That a lot of people can get behind and are becoming functionally integrated. Like, so we have a, you know, a local food hub in Boone, and they work with various like organic and you know, organic farmers. And, you know, if you go to a farmer's market, you get, you know, a pretty diverse array of ideologies, right? And sometimes you have like the conservative hippies, right? You have a lot of that, but you know, a lot of farmers are kind of this interesting, you know, organic farmers, small scale farmers are kind of this interesting mix of libertarian, but you know, very, very interested in organic food and permaculture, but then might be very conservative on other issues, right? And so there's this interesting mix. And so, I guess from what I've noticed so far is that I'm sure that there is tension and resentment, but I live about 10 miles outside of Boone, in, you know, a small, I wouldn't even call it a town. We have like a post office and a country store and we have a community center and a park. But that's about it. A couple other things. And it's definitely, you know, my neighbors are definitely more conservative. But, you know, to the extent that I've been able to meet my neighbors, you know, we haven't talked about politics. You know, we just talk about things that are practical. And, you know, everybody is respectful. And so, I don't know, for me personally, you know, I you know, try, you know, kind of being able to you know, to sense the room and to be able to kind of get along with people is a really fun challenge to do, right? And to mediate, basically, you know, not formally mimetic mediation, but just be able to, you know, how can I connect with this person, even though we're not going to agree on certain things, or what are the things that, you know, what are the areas that we connect on that is practical, you know, that creates this kind of functional interdependence that, you know, I think is, you know, will be so important moving forward. You know, and that's kind of what I really love about the framework of localism as well, is it's not, you know, it's almost a different axis, a different political axis, right? There's left, right, you know, and then this is more of a, you know, you can say localist again versus kind of neoliberal, right? And, you know, you have localists on both the left and the right, right? You have the anti-globalization leftists, right? And you have the anti-globalization, you know, right wingers. And there can definitely be some tension that arises. Honestly, a lot more of that tension has arisen online, on Twitter, right? Like various doom optimism, you know, optimism folks are more on the left and some are more on the right. And there's been, you know, some clashes, you know, on these kind of political questions. But just in person, you know, in this place, I haven't run into any real tension yet, at least not explicit.
You know, this is something that's really moved me more towards appreciating localism, right? Is that I think a lot of polarizations are much, it's much easier to work out these disagreements at the local level in the context of face-to-face local community than online being mediated by these social media platforms that are notorious for sparking, you know, really vitriolic interactions. But also, you know, our obsession as a country with national level politics, right, and national scale issues. And the more nationalized we are, the more polarized we become, right? We're lost in this realm of abstractions of what happens in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of policymakers that we have no connection with personally, with broad, you know, debating broad brush policies that are going to be imposed on everyone, whether we want them or not, you know, or, you know, so it's like a lot of this is out of our control. So we just fight about it. Not, you know, not diminishing the importance of effective national level regulations or top-down action, right? Top-down interventions, but the local community is where we can really reclaim our sense of agency and identity together as a community. And that's really something that I've taken to heart. And so a lot of times now when I get into political arguments, I say, well, what scale are we talking about here, right? Like, who am I at a local level is what I support and what I believe in. It might be completely different from what candidate I'm voting for in the presidential election.
Right. Yeah. No, one definition of localism I like is thinking about things in terms of minimum viable scale. And oftentimes, you know, the minimum viable scale, you know, in the context of the issue we're talking about. And, you know, many things, you know, the minimum viable scale is the neighborhood or the county or the town. Some things are national, I totally agree, or regional. And some things are planetary, right? I would say that with, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, you know, that's the global atmospheric commons, right? And, you know, there needs to be, you know, a discussion at the planetary level, talking about that, or something that, you know, I think we're gonna see more and more of a climate-induced refugee crisis. And I definitely think that's a global scale problem, that, you know, everybody, you know, every country needs to step up and figure out how to, you know, respond to that humanely. So I love how you put it, Ryan, of, you know, what scale are we talking about? You know, what scale best fits the problem? And one thing, again, I love about food is I feel like that's the lowest hanging fruit for very local scale, right? As much as possible. You know, much more than say technology, right? What is the scale of, you know, technology manufacturing, even kind of like traditional manufacturing, that might be more at a regional scale or a national scale. And so just trying to find what is the appropriate scale with the heuristic that can we find the minimum viable scale that we can handle this on and still cover it comprehensively.
That to me sounds like subsidiarity.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
What is subsidiarity? Educate me, please. I don't know what that is.
my understanding of it is that problems should be solved at the minimum viable scale at which they arrive at the lowest scale, instead of you know, trying to overscale with some kind of centralized authority, trying to solve problems at a scale that at a higher scale when really it could be resolved at a lower scale, and then trying to resolve it at the wrong scale creates a whole bunch of Cobra effects and second order unintended consequences that fuck everything up. So right. As a kind of heuristic, subsidiarity is valorizing localism and the smallest scale possible to solve problems that arise at that scale. Did I get that right, Jason?
Yeah, no, you got that right. And just with the added dimension of, you know, we talk about small scale and large scale, but I think you know, another way to think about it is broad scale. And how I, you know, think about broad scale is this kind of networked cosmopolitan localism where, you know, perhaps many things are happened at a smaller scale, but, you know, there's this kind of solidarity relationship, you know, all over the world, right? So, you know, you're in the Pacific Northwest, Ryan, and we're having a conversation, perhaps, you know, we might, you know, share experiences of various projects we've been in, you know, we might both glean ideas from that conversation that we'll take into our local communities. And I think that's incredibly valuable. And, you know, and I think it's also, you know, to prevent, you know, I think the failure mode of localism is, you know, it can turn into kind of an exclusionism, right? It can turn into, you know, kind of a, you know, it can turn contentious, right? Where you have, you know, various localities bumping into each other and fighting, right? You know, what we've seen in the past. And I think, you know, so I think in order to prevent that and also to, you know, to coordinate at these larger scales, you know, we don't necessarily have to think about it as like large scale top-down action, but perhaps we can think about it in terms of broad scale coordination. At least I think that's what technology perhaps, you know, especially like Web3 and things can perhaps afford us to do. And you know, I'd like to think that might be, you know, if we can create kind of a broad scale collective intelligence through these networks, that we can handle a lot of these larger scale issues in a not so top-down sense. That's the hope, right? It remains to be seen. We haven't gotten there yet, but that seems to be the hope of some of these new technologies as well.
And per the meta-ideological approach, this is where I really actually appreciate a lot of the inner literature on anarchism. And I think a lot of people have a negative reaction to the word anarchism, but, you know, people like Peter Kropotkin and Murray Bookchin, right, and other like eco-anarchists, or more like left anarchist, mutualist, mutual aid network, right, emphasizing the kind of power of self-organized, decentralized, voluntary networks where resources and aid and support of each other can be shared and networked. And broad scale, right? So you can have clusters, you've got fractal local, what should we call it? Cosmopolitan holarchy. There we go. Right. And kind of unleashing, how do we have the collective intelligence that can coherently organize at that scale, each entity containing its own sovereignty and sphere of independence, but also working collectively and coordinating our efforts towards solving emergent collective action problems that no one agent can solve, right? While trying to avoid the attractor of, you know, the kind of defection attractor of the prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah.
Right. And how do we, if we solve that, we basically save the world, I think. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's my hope. You know, that seems to be the best path forward. I mean, a very, I think, concrete example here is if we're thinking about, say, a watershed, right? And let's say a watershed has like, in this ideal, you know, idealized scenario, a watershed has like 10 villages, right? And, you know, in order to have ecological coherence, in order to avoid, you know, issues of externalities, you know, upstream, downstream problems, you need to have some kind of coherence at, say, a watershed scale, which You know, and the answer to that is not, you know, hopefully not kind of top-down dictate, you know, a dictator, you know, telling all the villagers what they have to do, but you have, as you said, you know, a bunch of self-sovereign communities that are also, but are connected and are able to communicate and coordinate, you know, for everybody's benefit, in, you know, various win-win scenarios. You know, and then you can just scale that up to the bioregional scale, you know, or, you know, there's ecological issues that, you know, I guess one might be like various, you know, habitats for certain species, right, that takes on a kind of bioregional scale. And to make sure that you have proper ecological corridors for these species, again, requires this kind of coordination at these larger scales. And so, yeah, I mean, that, you know, to figure out this coordination problem, to address these larger scale issues in an emergent fashion through collective intelligence, that to me seems the best hope for humanity. Absolutely.
I'm thinking of, as I always do, I'm thinking of like, okay, well, how do I play devil's advocate here? Because mm-hmm. there are some situations in which it's not the case that acting collaboratively for a given party is mm-hmm. better than not. You know, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the case of like the Sudan and Egypt and the Nile that flows through both of those countries. The Sudan mm-hmm. is damming up the Nile. So the Egyptians are kind of screwed and they're at the behest of the Sudanese. Mm-hmm. What's the Sudanese interest in not screwing over the Egyptians, given that they are Sudanese and not Egyptian?
Yeah.
And this is important, I think, because I think all the near-term wars and conflicts mm-hmm. in the world are going to have to do with water and water insecurity.
Yeah. You know, that's difficult. I think there are going to be wars. If I'm putting my realist lens on, I think there are going to be wars over resources. And I think, or there's going to be threat of wars, and some of these conflicts might be handled the old-fashioned way, either through war or through threat of war. You know, where both sides realize that they have too much to lose in going to war, and so they have to work something out at the last minute. You know, another thought that comes to my mind is, can the Egyptians figure out how to, say, harvest rainwater or to turn their desert back into, you know, a forested ecosystem through various permacultural methods that makes them less dependent on Sudan, you know, for their very life. I don't know. I don't know enough about that specific context to be able to say that. I'm sure if I had an Egyptian on, they would say I was an idiot.
No, I think I've been looking into it recently, so that's why it's on the mind. Yeah. That is what the Egyptians are doing. They're trying to spread out from Cairo, which is too dense to be sustainable, and they are investing heavily in water desalinization so that they can turn the ocean
right. And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, I don't think we're gonna solve human nature overnight and tribalism overnight. And, you know, I think that there is going to be some old fashioned kind of game theory going on of, and, you know, again, if I'm putting my realist lens on, I think that there is going to be a lot of conflict. And I don't know how to avoid that. I don't know. I'm curious. What you think. If you were to answer your devil's advocate question, how would you respond?
No, I agree. I think global policy is where a lot of the game B metamodernism mm-hmm. stuff tends to fall apart.
Yeah.
Because the game B answer to that is we're going to solve human nature.
Yeah.
Basically, we're going to alter things a little bit to solve human nature, and then the Sudanese and the Egyptians are just going to love each other.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem likely, actually.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, this might be where, you know, again, you know, if the minimum viable scale to answer this issue is a global scale with global institutions, you know, preferably institutions that work well, right? I mean, the United Nations has kind of like been the institution that's supposed to work, you know, work through these issues. And, you know, I'm sure it could do a lot better. a while back on both ends, we interviewed a guy who was, I shouldn't have even brought it up if I didn't remember. Simple System, the Simple, S-I-M-P-L.
Dunzel, Defoe?
Yeah, Bunzel. And so I'm all for people who are working in the space of better kind of international institutions that can handle these issues. And you know, and John Bunzel seems to be convinced that his system could potentially handle these global issues more effectively than, say, the United Nations. And if it's true, then I'm saying, go forth, right? Go forth and prosper. Like that's certainly what we need. I guess the fear that a lot of people have is that you get this kind of global totalitarian regime, right? Yeah. That turns into a nightmare. I don't think anybody wants that. But global, and then you get into this distinction between global government and global governance, right? And is that a meaningful distinction? Perhaps it could be. Perhaps it could be. Global governance to me implies, more of a kind of, kind of global scale coordination, using new innovative mechanisms that, might be enhanced through technology or other means, new voting mechanisms, things of that nature. We're heading into a brave new world here. And I don't think anybody knows how some of these conflicts, these seemingly irresolvable conflicts, are going to play out.
Yeah, I'm reminded of something that Nassim Taleb was talking about in Anti-Fragile. But there's another side of it where I don't see him or any Talebians talking about. I'm wondering if I just missed it. But he was basically talking about how you could have, at a lower scale, the agents themselves in conflicts can be fragile. But the result of that is a higher level anti-fragility, right? So the example would be like in evolution, organisms that are in conflict with each other are fragile to be, being eaten by predators or going extinct. But over the course of time and at the emergent level, you end up selecting for the most resilient, most adaptive organisms, right? Or in the market context and economics, individual businesses are fragile and are susceptible to being selected out of the business pool, right? Yeah. But at the collective level, we have a market system or capitalist system that selects for the most efficient value creating firms, right? In theory. So what I'm most concerned about is the opposite, right? Where lower level agents in conflict fragilize the higher level. So one example is something like political polarization, where and Jared Jaynes really enlightened me about this, where individual mimetic tribes in conflict are actually anti-fragile, right? The more we hate each other and attack each other, the more we double down on our own tribe in our own little microsphere. But then what happens is we fragilize the collective, we fragilize democracy, we fragilize civil society, right? The higher level is a threat. Obviously, with climate change, this is a very obvious example where individual agents might find them, let's say corporations or governments might find the most efficient way to create products and do business and create profits. Yeah. But we end up destroying the environment and the commons, and the collective higher dimension becomes fragilized at the expense of lower level anti-fragility. So it's like, my whole thing is thinking about how individual, whether they're nation states or businesses or just mimetic tribes in a country, how do we leverage this micro rivalry into macro symbiosis, as Daniel Schmachtenberger says, right? And this is what I think about as a mediator. To me, this is the deepest question, given that we can't change human nature and that we'll always have conflict. I'll always have business as, in the kind of doing my job, right? How do we create an atmosphere or design a system where conflict between individual agents at the lower scale creates emergent positive externalities for everyone? Kind of like a more holistic take on the invisible hand, right? Where we have a truly, truly, holistic and beneficial, omni-beneficial invisible hand, that where individual conflict can lead to collective growth and learning and adaptation. I don't know what that, I have a few ideas of what that looks like, but I don't know, I wouldn't dare fuck with that at a higher scale outside,
Like, I don't know if you've heard of like mechanism design.
Oh yeah.
Economics. This feels like a mechanism design problem. I remember talking with Gregory Landra of Regen Network, and one way that he described what he's doing is, you know, he sees him, what he's doing as kind of a realist project of basically harnessing people's kind of entrepreneurship and even selfishness, you know, towards regeneration of the planet. And, you know, one way you put it is like, how do you do that? You pay them money, right? You pay them money to, you know, maintain their topsoil, to plant cover crops, to plant trees. You know, you pay them money to provide ecological corridors. You know, another way to put it is, you know, a lot of agriculture or industry in general, you know, externalizes the costs, right? And that's an incentive design problem, I guess you could say. And so if you can, you know, change the incentives where all of a sudden, you know, people aren't rewarded for externalizing costs, but are rewarded for externalizing benefit, right? Through just gross, giving them, you know, giving them money, giving them carbon credits or whatever. You know, that might be one way, you know, so, you know, that model just applied to other societal issues as well, might be part of it. You know, I'm not steeped in the mechanism design space. It's more mathematics than I can handle, to be fair.
Read the Wikipedia page for mechanism design. It's like, it looks like Egyptian hieroglyphics, actually. It's like,
yeah, no, it's crazy. I mean, I took, you know, in my PhD economics, I was taking a kind of the game theory course, that included a section of mechanism design, and, you know, it was just, hieroglyphics is exactly right. I mean, it's just, you know, by the end of it, I barely understood what was even happening, you know, enough to like get a few points on an exam, right? Kind of mimic some of the equations I didn't understand.
It's a mystifying field, I think. I was looking into it for a couple of months, because I do think it's hugely involved in whatever the next system is going to be, but I'm not smart enough to tell what it is.
And as a good, you know, as a good localist, I also harbor some skepticism as well. So one thing that we're gonna, you know, when Ashley and I were talking about having Gregory on, you know, Ashley is more skeptical than me about this project. And, you know, one of her concerns, and my concern as well, is this issue of legibility, right? And this relates to kind of the James C. Scott thing, like a state, where, you know, if you can measure, you know, trying to measure everything that's important to you in order to incentivize it correctly, can have really deleterious effects on the culture itself. Because there's so many aspects of communities and culture that are extremely difficult to measure. And if you start measuring certain things, you're gonna probably start with things that are easiest to measure, and you're gonna prioritize those things. And you can just totally, you know, undermine the culture from within by doing that. And I don't think that's an issue that's been resolved, right? Because I think that, you know, one way that Joe Norman put it is he made a distinction between legibility and interfaceability. And I'm not quite sure what that would mean in practice, where, you know, in his view, you know, you want these communities to be able to interface with each other, which I guess is some kind of collaboration. So there's some kind of, like, you can say, emergent output that is public to public view, but you're not becoming legible to them, meaning there's just no way they could understand you from the inside out, because they don't live there. And this is a similar problem in kind of my critique of, like, mainstream development field, you know, which I was kind of, you know, part of in kind of a food system sense, you know, my PhD program, where, you know, you have these experts coming in, gathering data for a few weeks, and then coming back and crunching the data, and then thinking that they have the best policy for your development. And I ended up deciding that was all pretty much bullshit. You know, in order to, and this is also the difference between kind of a technocratic, you know, sensibility, which I think mechanism design definitely fits into, versus kind of an emergence oriented evolutionary process, which is very hard to quantify. And so I don't have the answers. So I, you know, in the earlier conversation, I was thinking, yeah, you know, in order to handle these large issues, mechanism design, that sounds great. But then the other part of myself was like, no. Like, I'm very wary of that stuff. And I'm still kind of, you know, I'm uncertain. I'm hoping that our conversation with Gregory, which, you know, I think Ashley will take the skeptics viewpoint, you know, will help to resolve some of these issues, because I think Gregory has thought a lot about these issues, and I'm suspecting that he'll have really good answers to our skepticism. And I hope that there's some kind of, you know, some kind of a synthesis here that might be some kind of trade-off that, you know, is acceptable. Yeah. I don't know.
I think there is, and I like the oscillation actually between the mechanism design, like very mystifying. It's you can't even understand. It's not legible, and the grassroots thing of going in the community. And I was reading a paper in mechanism design when I was trying to get a hold on it, and there's all these symbols and things. And what it came down to at the end was we should pay poachers not to poach. Which, like, right. You pay them and then they don't do it, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the end, it ends up being pretty concrete, actually, and pretty commonsensical. So, why do we have to do it in the first place? I don't know. And I always thought, like, for COVID, we should pay people to get vaccinated, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, they did. They tried. They did all kinds of experiments doing that.
They tried it in Indiana, I remember. You know, there are all these sweepstakes and things that you could enter, and I thought that would work better than this just persuasion thing that they're trying to do.
Well, I think another distinction that's important here is like Dave Snowden's Kinevan model of like complicated and complex and simple, right?
Yeah.
And just to kind of tie some of these things together, I mean, one of the problems with overly bureaucratic measurement infrastructure is that you consolidate complex phenomena down into simple ones, right? As if they could be entered into a spreadsheet and just kind of linearly computed to get some kind of output that we can then implement into a complex context that usually doesn't work very well, right? And so you can't capture, you know, to use Nord Bateson's from the warm data, the living data, the context sensitive data, using those kind of simple metrics, right? Or, and there's also like Goodhart's law and Campbell's law, right? Where when a metric becomes a target, it fails to become a good metric because it gets corrupted by the incentives which distort the data collection process. Not to mention, I think another problem too with the stick and carrot approach too is that both of those are not really the best way of dealing with complexity, in the sense that unfortunately we have to revert to intrinsic motivation is from an internal standpoint kind of the best impulse to deal with complexity. Because if you're chasing a carrot, you're incentivized to not do the best thing in that context, because you're going to do the thing that will get you the bonus or the fulfill that incentive. And if you're getting away from a stick, you're also not going to do the best thing in that unique moment because you're trying not to get punished for doing the wrong thing.
So you're going to learn how to game the system.
You're going to learn. So here's my idea though. Okay. So my idea was, given that it's inevitable that people are going to find ways to game the system, can we design to the best of our capability an incentive structure that when gamed produces unintended positive externalities? And I've thought about what this would look like in terms of funders in Portland. So just some concrete examples. So in 2017, a lot of major Portland foundations got together and had a meeting about what they were going to prioritize funding in terms of offering funding to nonprofits and other civic organizations and community initiatives. And what they decided to, of course, was really congregate around funding DEI, social justice, racial justice stuff. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was that every time an organization applied for a grant, and I just applied for one recently through my organization, it's like, you look at the questions, I'd say 50% of them are like DEI questions. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that every organization tried to outwoke each other to get funding. Well, there's some good things that came about that, sure. Like they're trying to hire, you know, if they're trying to prioritize hiring people of color and elevating minority voices, I was hired, yay. But then the bad thing was, well, that creates a lot of polarization that, you know, that kind of signaling game becomes really problematic. And a lot of organizational cultures just went down in flames over trying to implement DEI practices that everyone got really pissed off about. And so it's like, well, what would if I was a billionaire and could talk to all of the major foundations and grant making agencies in the area and say, well, let's tinker with some of the metrics, right? What should people shoot for that they can report on so that they would get funding? And in the process of trying to hit those targets, they would accidentally create positive ripple effects that they weren't trying to create. And yeah. So I had some ideas of what those metrics could look like, but I'll just stop there and say that's my kind of fantasy.
No, I'm curious what your ideas were, because it's really intriguing, but I have no idea what that would look like.
So here it is. So it's basically, things like mimetic mediation, ideological and political depolarization, valuing viewpoint diversity, really taking polarization into consideration and trying to build some kind of community or culture that transcends that and can work together towards some kind of beneficial collective action. And so it would be very much kind of like integrally or other metrics for organizations that were doing this. Let's say, like, instead of affirmative action hiring in terms of race and identity, it would be that plus diverse political ideology too. So you'd have liberals and conservatives working together, and then companies would have to find incentive to make that work. Then they'd hire me to come in and work with them and do a mimetic mediation training for all of the employees and develop a culture, assist and kind of accountability protocol to look at that and to cultivate that mindset. So that was kind of my fantasy.
Yeah. Are you familiar with this framework of participatory budgeting?
Yep.
I'm curious what you think about that process and how, because that seems to kind of combine where you allocate, a certain amount of funding for this process, at a like a municipal level. But then in theory, then you have this kind of participatory democratic process of deciding what gets funded, through different groups developing kind of their own proposals and then voting on those proposals. And, and part of the benefit of it is not just the outcome, but the actual process of developing the proposals and the skill building and people connecting with each other and getting to know each other and stuff. I'm curious has that been implemented where you are in Portland?
I hate to say this, but I'm actually not sure. I know I've studied other places where it has been implemented, and some places more successfully than others. So they did one in on Vancouver Island in Victoria that was very successful. There was one in Southern California that was very successful. And that's part of the larger conversation on participative and deliberative democracy that also produces, that's supposed to, Ireland is a lot of great examples of this going well, right? Where you get diverse citizens and stakeholder groups together. And in the process of collaborating and coming up with the budget and determining what to fund and what not to, right, you're able to kind of affirmatively cultivate the collective intelligence of the community through a mechanism like participatory budgeting. Of course, there are a lot of problems. There's a selection bias problem. There's, kind of like the jury duty question of like, do we force people to come? Should it be voluntary? If it's voluntary, it's going to skew to a certain demographic. How is it going to be facilitated? Power dynamics that come up in the facilitation. So I'm interested in doing more of this kind of work because I do think positive externalities can come out of that alongside with coming up with an intelligent, budgeting plan. But I think how it's executed, how it's designed is really the variable, not just like, does it work or not? I think it's really context dependent.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. It brings to mind, going back to this notion of localism, is this distinction between, so there's kind of a big distributist movement in localism, like G.K. Chesterton and others, who, their basic proposal is that, well, we don't need to worry about all of this participatory democratic stuff. We really just need to worry about more broad distribution of ownership, especially land ownership. And then what can arise out of that is beneficial relationships, among neighbors, markets, small scale businesses, kind of a village economy can arise out of that. And then kind of the alternative viewpoint is more of like, well, we need to democratize the means of production, including, land ownership. And then you get, people more interested in kind of collectives and cooperatives and things of that nature. And, you know, I've always kind of been ambivalent. I kind of can see a role for both types of systems in a cosmological future, where you have different communities kind of landing at different, you know, parts of that spectrum, you know. So if it's not fully distributist, or it's not fully, let's say, mutualist, you know, but you might have some kind of hybrid structures. And somebody who's written really, really well about this is Chris Mage. He wrote the book Small Farm Future, which is a great book. And he's definitely from the left, but over time he's become kind of disillusioned with like cooperatives, and where he kind of stands now is he leans more distributist, and you know, basically arguing that there is a role for cooperatives, but they generally, you know, they're most successful when basically the distributist model just cannot work, right? So when say farmers, for example, need to you know, scale up their operations through a cooperative, and so it's clearly in everybody's best interest to do so, right? But you know, once the conditions for that change, then they'll go back to their own local production and, you know, kind of local market economies. I'm curious what you think about that kind of distinction, either of you.
I think what we were talking about earlier with the question of scale plays in there. Yeah. When you get to a industry gets to such a scale that it's actually impossible to just cleave it up in a distributist way. You can't cleave up Google. It stops working at that point because it gets its power from its breadth. So it needs to
be economies of scale. Yeah.
Right. So in that sense, I lean more toward the, I call it mutualist, although that term is, it's used in different ways, but you know, there we publicize the means of wealth making, whereas at the smaller scale, local farms and such, it would be in the other direction.
Right. Right. No, I mean, one interesting dynamic that has come up is, you know, there's been tension between, say, people who just, they want to unionize the workers in Amazon or Walmart, right? But they're, you know, they've become, and this is more on kind of like the left, but they've kind of become comfortable with large scale business. They just want to take over the means of production of it, right? But they're kind of on board with this kind of more industrial, large scale model, you know. And then, you know, of course, the localists push back against that, and it's like, you know, kind of LOL, like, you just want to unionize Walmart. What we really need to do is, you know, bring back Main Street, right? And bring back like local crafts and manufacturing. And this is, you know, kind of become a hot point where, you know, a lot of harsh words have been thrown both directions. But the practicalities of something like distributism is unclear. Like, how would you enforce, how would you enforce kind of a limit to scale? That would require some pretty heavy-handed top-down action, probably. And it's not clear how that would come about otherwise. And so I guess there's some paradoxes here.
It would be top-down, or it could be in some sense consensus-driven, which we would hope that a well-functioning democracy would be in any event if it's top-down. Yeah. But maybe the current system wouldn't be. So some kind of consensus model to come up with, okay, when do we shift towards this mutualist versus distributist imperative? But that involves the capacity for people to think critically together, which that's what we need to figure out first. I think
they're different. Go ahead, Jason.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, just I have a lot of thoughts on the cooperative stuff. I mean, they're different. So first of all, this is old Marxist debate too, of like, you know, how radical do we want to be in terms of socializing the means of production and moving towards a fully communist kind of a game B utopian society, right? Or should we have things like workers unions so that workers and the proletariat and so forth can get a better deal in the current capitalist system? But in doing that, the long-term argument against it is that you just strengthen the capitalist system, right? By subsuming, let's say we have higher wages for workers, that's great, who work in Amazon, but then you allow the kind of capitalist neoliberal regime to continue living by appeasing the workers and not having them revolt or whatever, right? And even within that, there are a lot of other, there are other, you know, categories of cooperative. Like, so like one would be like an employee stock ownership plan model or ESOP. So Harvard Business Review did a review of different ESOP companies like Winco Foods. And according to that study, they did show that they were, you know, employee morale was better. And not only were they paid better with better benefits, but they're also, the companies were more efficient and were just better all around, which of course begs the question. So if those companies are more efficient, why doesn't the capitalist system select for that kind of model over a conventional model, right? And then there's the whole conversation around what we talked about in our group, Nate, about co-determination and actually having it mandated via the federal government that corporations at a certain scale need to have a certain, need to have union leaders or workers represented on the board. And so they'll actually vote and would more directly represent worker interests instead of just leaving it all up to upper management, CEOs and shareholders and the board, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's another model of like subsuming worker interests into the overall corporate entity.
Well, that so model, it's not, it routes around the need for unions, actually.
Exactly, you subsume the union into the organizational body, right? But when I think the real questions you're talking about in terms of land and ownership, and I think that's actually where I'm most full-on authoritarian, heavy-handed, top-down. I think at this point, you know, you're looking at these companies, what was it, BlackRock, whatever, just buying up all these like real estate properties and houses, buying up, we have private corporations buying up entire neighborhoods. I say we have a federally enacted progressive real estate tax where after your third or fourth or fifth house, you get taxed so hard. And it's a big problem too in the Midwest and like in Iowa, right, where you have rich people buying up all the farmland. And farmers are getting a raw deal. And so unless there's, and it has to be, in my opinion, combated at the national level, at a higher scale, because if we leave property taxes to the local jurisdictions, people will just buy up property everywhere else. So not every local locality in the US can coordinate to do that. So we just need to enact at the federal level and fuck people who are hoarding shit, basically. I'm off my soapbox.
I mean, I think that's interesting. I mean, one way I phrase it is like, what is the meta stable framework for localism to thrive? Right. And, you know, it's, you know, in kind of, you know, if we're assuming kind of the status quo in terms of collapse, that, you know, collapse, you know, kind of more catastrophic collapse is pretty far into the future. If we're assuming, you know, what it would take, you know, for that to happen, you would need, you know, basically some kind of political revolution, which, you know, a lot of people are uncomfortable with, you know, and I'm not sure that, you know, after the failures of like the Bernie campaign and stuff, like, I just don't know if we could pull it off. With that said, you know, I wanna bring in kind of my adaptive cycle, panarchy kind of doomer perspective, you know, C.S. Halling, where basically, you know, according to a lot of people, we're kind of, you know, approaching the back loop where, you know, we're in this rigidity phase where like nothing's happening and there's going to be some kind of release, you know, another name for collapse, where, you know, there's going to be a lot of chaos, supply chains going to break down, you know, perhaps some kind of financial collapse, you know, perhaps food and energy shortages, you know, related to climate and other things. And what, you know, while it's, you know, it's going to be, you know, if that actually occurred to some severity, it's going to be horrific, at least for some people, perhaps us. But, you know, also like what, you know, after the back loop is, and the release is this kind of all of a sudden a new set of energy for like a kind of a, you know, transition to a new system state. Basically, you know, basically a new set of opportunities to you know, to transform the system. And there's multiple trajectories. It could turn into, you know, a new feudalism where all of these, you know, BlackRock and Bill Gates buying up all this land become our new feudal overlords. Or it could, you know, perhaps it can turn into something more resilient, regenerative. And perhaps it'll be all of the above. It'll be kind of like a patchwork. Right, depending on where you are, you'll have like, eco-villages and worker cooperatives somewhere, and then somewhere else you'll have these kind of feudalistic villages and, you know, manufacturing centers or something. So you know, taking this conversation and throwing in the element of a crumbling, unstable, you know, system. I'm curious what you guys think.
First of all, that is how like the medieval period happened. There were all these
dark ages happened. And
there was also the Byzantine Empire for a really long time.
Yeah,
you know, maintaining the old system. So it is never all or one. Yeah. So I think you're right in thinking that it would be a patchwork of different kinds of patchworks.
Yeah.
And you know, my go-to phrase that I love from Herbert Croly's book called Promise of the American Life, I think he calls it Hamiltonian means to Jeffersonian ends, right? Like there is a place for this kind of Hamiltonian, big centralized authority action in terms of, doing everything we can, using the powers of government to transform the system in a metastable way to unleash the power of this kind of Jeffersonian, localist, agricultural, bioregional, regenerative system. And I think there are different ways we can do that. You know, I favor a combination of very strong progressive moves, both in terms of, what I said in terms of like, tax mechanisms to deter hoarding and, infrastructural developments that can actually curb inflation, and also libertarian policies of intelligently deregulating places, bottlenecks and other, inefficiency gaps in the system writ large. And so I think both of those, with the goal of moving towards this kind of future that I think, Jason, we all know is like, we have to do this or else humanity is going to die, right? But yeah. It's not that, the use of big government to me is not an end in and of itself. It's a Hamiltonian means to Jeffersonian ends right? So that's kind of like the end attractor state I have in mind, and how can we use the tools of government to help shepherd us along the way without knowing that it's the final solution or final answer or whatever.
Yeah, I think I agree. The Hamiltonian means, assuming that, they don't get co-opted, by some specific group or set of interests, right? That, I think we've seen in the past. It's going to be interesting because I I'm definitely of the mind that the next couple of decades, I do think that the current status quo industrial capitalist globalist system can just cannot thermodynamically maintain itself, especially with increasing climate instability. How we're going to think about enacting these coherent policies at, say, a national level, these kind of Hamiltonian type policies towards Jeffersonian ends, is very unclear to me, right? Especially with, if you imagine increasing chaos, more tribal warfare, regional warlords rising, people scapegoating each other, like, their lives are becoming harder, and so they have to find a scapegoat. So just a generally more chaotic environment, right? How do we, if we can't, on the one hand, it might be enough impetus to, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, and to figure things out. But yeah, it just seems like it's going to be a whole new ballgame once, once a lot of the things we take for granted, like, showing up to the supermarket and having abundant food supply, or, not having, blackouts with our energy grid and things of that nature. Once those things that we can't really take for granted anymore, how these dynamics are going to change.
Yeah. And let me just say, I think there are some real, real primordial risks, right, that you just mentioned that I don't have the know-how or have any solutions in that regard. But just as a practical example with what I'm saying, so my wife and I are looking into buying a house somewhere. We were looking in rural Washington, and there are some great towns that were great, right? There were small towns. We can both work online, and the houses are, the property values are not too high, like in the city, so that's great. And the property taxes in that county are low, which is great. Oh, there's one problem. They don't have broadband. And given that we work online, we need to have some kind of solid, you know, internet connection.
Yeah.
And so what prevented us from moving to several houses was simply the fact that there was no broadband infrastructure in the area.
Yeah.
And so if we had some kind of universal broadband infrastructure as well, like Bernie proposed, it would actually allow for people to freely move. And then, you know, if I'm actually, you know, kind of limited where I live here, because, you know, it's we're renters. So we don't have that much freedom in terms of what to do with the land. But we were looking at, you know, property with significant acreage, we can have our goats and the whole permaculture, all of that was stopped because we don't have broadband, right? Yeah. So it's like, if there are certain things that are put in place that would actually enable people to move more freely and, you know, let the forces of supply and demand work more intelligently, so people can start living a local resilient kind of lifestyle, that would be, I think there are some micro steps we can do in the meantime to help get us there. Although that's not, of course, by any means the final answer for anything.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. You know, it's, I guess another way to put it is, you know, how do you, you know, ruralize the population, or just, you know, promote a more distributed population, but that's still connected to do this kind of sense making and decision making. You know, I think I absolutely agree with you. You know, I think that, you know, that can afford a lot of people to, you know, and this whole thing about like remote work, you know, I think, you know, a lot more people are moving to remote work, and that this is an interesting development as well. You know, it does afford more of this flexibility. You know, some people would argue it causes more gentrification, right? So there's that whole issue, like rural gentrification. And so, you know, and I kind of see that as a bridge towards, yeah, like being able to work remotely is great, but, you know, can you start, you know, one, can you invest that into the local economy? And two, can you, you know, eventually perhaps start generating some of your income, you know, locally as well? And so can it be a bridge rather than just kind of, you know, a form of gentrification where rich people move out on their larger estates and don't really utilize the land well and things of that nature. Yeah, that would be an interesting challenge.
Yeah, I have two thoughts on that. One is, you know, with the remote work in the wake of COVID and everything, and yeah, the rural gentrification thing, I haven't thought about it too much, but I can imagine that being a huge problem, not to mention cultural and mimetic clashes, right, that occur as a result of that mass, you know, migration transformations. But I wonder about like things like a UBI, like if people could get also basic income that they could also more liberally dump into the local economy and circulate it in those local sectors, and also enable more, you know, freer movement. I wonder if that would be helpful. Right? Jordan Hall has an interesting video where he basically says like UBIs can be a tonic for market intelligence. All right, kind of like that framing. The other thing I'm thinking about too is like alternative currencies. And like and each town, like I think Vermont did actually, was it Burlington, I think, might have done like the mayor, there was some kind of like a public initiative for an alternative currency there, and it was apparently very successful. So you can have, you know, multi-currency economies where certain types of value can stay in the community, right? So it's not all this, we're just not all, I'll move to a really cheap place, I'll get paid online, I'll dump everything in Amazon, right? That's a problem. But maybe, you know, having alternative currencies and other ways to connect unused resources with unused labor could be something to be interesting to dig into deeper.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I wonder, you know, again, going back to like the Web3, you know, platforms of like what, you know, what that can afford in terms of like monetary localism. You know, I've been following, I've been following Holochain for a few years. It still seems like it's in beta, like they're still kind of developing it. But that seems to be, to me, in terms of like, you know, the Web3 space, that to me, that's the most promising, in theory at least, development of just, you know, being able to basically kind of create these digital commons of and currency exchange and things like that, and just peer-to-peer networking in general. Yeah, no, it's kind of beyond my, you know, like beyond my expertise, but it's something that's like, okay, like something like this, some kind of, you know, multi-currency, that captures value in different ways as well, right? That doesn't just review, you know, that is, you know, some that is fungible, some that is non-fungible, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we're going to need something along those lines, right? And so that's one reason why, you know, I'm trying to help connect the doomer optimism space with these technological developments, because I think it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, longer term, you know, we're going to need, you know, or it just might be very simple, just a local physical currency of, you know, that you print. You know, of course, that's, I think that's what they did in New York, right? The example you gave, what's the town again?
I think it was in a town in Vermont.
Oh, it was a town in Vermont. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Nate, don't you like own Holochain or something?
Yeah. Holochain's interesting.
Tell us about Holochain, Nate. Tell us what you think the promise of Holochain is.
Again, with you, it's out of my depth, really, but the vibes are so good.
Yeah, I like the vibes. That's my main attraction. So thank
you. I like the vibes. I heard about it on the Emerge podcast, which I listened to you, the Emerge podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you go on there? I think that's where I...
Yeah, Jared and I went on the Emerge podcast once.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so I like the vibes, and I like that, I mean, as you say, the it's processing power, really, is what you buy with Holochain, which is interesting and seems more concrete and realistic than, you know, purely symbolic currency. You can actually do something with what you're buying. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Well, this has been quite the conversation. I think to sum it up, we're doomed, but we're feeling optimistic.
We're happy to be here.
Yeah, Jason, thank you so much for coming on. This has been fantastic, just to kind of shoot the shit and riff.
No, I think we just, you know, this is a nice conversation because we ran up against a lot of really core problems and then we kind of stumbled around a little bit. But I think that's what everybody's doing because, you know, the future is just so blurry. And, you know, hopefully, you know, a lot of these kind of irresolvable, you know, seemingly irresolvable challenges, you know, start taking more form that we can actually relate to and, you know, in a real way. But I don't think anybody's there yet, right? We're all just kind of stumbling around in the dark. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.